So hello and welcome to another edition of the Ice World podcast. I'm your host, marine biologist Nadia Frontier. In this episode, we're turning the world upside down, depending on where you are, by heading to the UK's only Arctic station. New Ålesund is operated by the British Antarctic Survey and is located in Svalbard at 78 degrees of northerly latitude. The first of my two guests today is Ian Rudkin, Arctic Operations Manager at New Ålesund, and speaking to us from Svalbard. Henry Burgess is at the British Antarctic Survey's headquarters in Cambridge. He is the head of the Natural Environment Research Council's Arctic Office, or NERC for short. NERC operates New Ålesund Station, provides advice to policymakers, and supports international scientific cooperation in the Arctic. Welcome, both of you. Ian, can you describe the view that you have outside your window right now in the Arctic?
Yes, no problem. Yes, so I'm currently sat in the station manager's office in Harland Kokshuset, which is situated in a village, but I can see through the buildings to the glaciers to the west of our station. And we've got a relatively ambient temperature of about 7 degrees outside, so quite pleasant. And we have teams out on the glaciers and another one's just arrived on a plane. So lovely day in New Ålesund.
Sounds like a busy polar day. Amazing. And Henry, thank you very much for joining us from Cambridge. How long have you been part of the NERC Arctic Office?
Well, I joined in 2016, so best part of 10 years. And our job here is to promote UK Arctic researchers wherever they are, if they're within the British Antarctic Survey, where we're hosted, but in universities and research centres.
How many times have you made it up to Svalbard?
That's a good question. Probably about 9, 10 in total, something like that, usually for a week, something like that, taking up members of parliament or ministers. We had the foreign secretary there a month or so ago. So it tends to be with guests rather than supporting science projects.
Wow, very important role. And Henry, can you describe to us your journey into the British Antarctic Survey after serving as a civil servant in a range of government departments?
Yeah, I've had a very meandering career, really. I sometimes go to conferences and people say, you know, how did you get into this work? And I say, well, it's a series of very, very happy accidents. And I wouldn't recommend necessarily that anyone try and follow my tortuous career path to where I am now. But I worked in the Cabinet Office and Department for Culture, Media and Sport and Office of the Deputy Prime Minister and various other places. And then I was in the Foreign Office in the Polar Regions Department. We were looking mostly after Antarctic issues. And then this opportunity came up to move into the Arctic world 9 years ago. And I jumped at it with both feet and haven't looked back. It's a really, really good job. It's practical and interesting. There's big politics involved and kind of practical work. So it's fantastic. It really is a good opportunity to make a difference in the Arctic world.
And Ian, you've been at the British Antarctic Survey for a while. When did you first join?
So I first joined BAS in 2009. As a field guide, used to work as a chemist and latterly in cancer research. And I had a long desire to come to Antarctica, and by far the cheapest way is to get a job there. And so I applied rather speculatively as a field guide for an overwintering position at Rothera, and was fairly surprised to get it, and originally treated it as a sabbatical from chemistry, but extended to double winter, and I've never really gone back. Rothera was based as a field guide out of there for about 7 seasons, and did a season at Cygni, and then moved over to the dark side in tourism for a number of years, and then came back to BAS to work at the Arctic Station in 2021.
What was the jump like from going to the Antarctic stations to the Arctic Station?
There's a lot of similarities, you know, in terms of some of the weather you encounter, but I think the big difference for me up in the north is the varied nature of the work. So, you know, in summer now, it's actually quite temperate. It can be quite pleasant, sometimes worryingly warm. And yet in the winter, you know, it can be sort of minus 30. So, you know, whereas Antarctica tends to be more constantly polar in terms of people's mindset, the Arctic definitely has distinct seasons between summer and winter. And it means, you know, the interest for the job in winter, there's a lot of skidoo work and glacier work. And in the summer, there's a lot more boat work. So it's actually really enhances the job in a variety of ways.
And Ian, how long has NERC Arctic Office supported Arctic research at New Ålesund?
So there was a big interest in the UK, you know, since, you know, I think it's over 50 years. Started off as the Spitsbergen expeditions led by Brian Harland, who is one of the names the hut is named after that we stay in. And that then became the Cambridge Arctic Shelf Programme, which you may be aware of. It's situated very close to Bass, and there's a lot of crossover between geologists going between Bass and CASP. But then in 1991, Nick Cox, my predecessor, managed to secure the funding from NERC to establish a research station in Ullesund. And in 1992, the building was built. So we are just over 30 years old. We celebrated our 30th anniversary in 2022. And as part of that, and also to mark the occasion of Nick Cox's retirement, we changed the name from Harland Huset to Harland Cox Huset. So it's got a strong history of British researchers and sort of operational staff supporting science in the name, and long may it continue.
Excellent. Henry, in addition to the British Research Station, how many other countries maintain a research presence in the Svalbard village of New Ålesund?
It's a really fascinating place, New Ålesund, because it's genuinely unique in the Arctic, in that we have so many different countries, so many different facilities brought together in one place, all operating as one big team, essentially. So there are 10 countries. Is that still right, Ian? 10 countries represented in New Ålesund. Yep. So we've got the UK, of course. We've got Norway, who are everyone's hosts. They provide all the services and the facilities. We all rent our stations from the Norwegians. So there's the UK, Norway. We have the Netherlands, Italy, France, and Germany completing the European contingent. And then from Asia, we have Korea, India, China, and Japan. So it's really, really international. And what's even more important than that is that through different schemes that different countries run, particularly the UK, but others too, other researchers from all around the world, from outside those 10 countries, can come and work at the stations as well. So it genuinely is open to the world. And one of the really cool things when you visit the UK station in our sitting room, there are the flags all around the sitting room wall of all the different countries of the people that have worked with us in our station in New Ålesund. And I think we're well over 40 countries now, aren't we, Ian? How many?
Yeah, we're about 45, yeah. I think, which is a fairly large section of the, and that comes from across the different continents as well. So it's a really widespread.
So it really is an international facility in the Arctic, and it's unique and really important, particularly now.
And in terms of calling it a village, are there any native people there?
New Ålesund itself, the town, it began as a mining town back, over 100 years ago. And back in those days, you know, when there was a mining community here, it was very much a family town. There was, families with children and everyone lived here. And actually the Indian station, which is called Hamadri, that is in the old schoolhouse. So it's where all the kids went to school. And in town at the minute, we have, I think, four people from the New Ålesund Veterans Club, who never worked here, but they were actually here as school kids. And they've kept that connection going on.
And Henry, can you describe the layout of the village? What does it look like?
You can probably walk from one end of the village to the other in 10 minutes, something like that. Relatively small, but a wonderful setting right on the fjord edge. So you can walk down from our station down to the dock of an evening, and you look right out to sea, looking away to the west. And then the other end, you can look right up to the head of the fjord, sort of 10 kilometers away, probably at least. And you see these beautiful kind of turquoise blue glaciers coming right down to the water's edge, and occasionally there'll be an iceberg come past, or seals. You can see whales from the dock. You often get beluga in the fjord. It's a really special location.
Sounds idyllic. And Ian, what's the range that people can move whilst they're on station without boat? Is there quite a large area for recreation?
So recreation's not impossible, but it's very different to Rothera, and that's largely because of the polar bear, the existence of the polar bear. We are in a good way, we're in the land of the polar bear, and certain months of the year, particularly sort of June and May, they can be seen almost daily. Mothers, cubs coming through the town, which is fantastic. Well, I say through the town, past the town, which is fantastic to see. But it does mean that, you know, wandering out into town for a jog is not quite as simple as it might be in, say, Rothera. It's a legal requirement that we need to carry protection against polar bears, and the local regulations stipulate that that has to be lethal and non-lethal. So we have to carry firearms out with us. So it's actually sometimes easier just to go out as a couple or two or three people and go out for a walk across the tundra and just explore it at a more leisurely pace.
And Ian, what does your job as an Arctic operation manager actually involve? What's your day-to-day like?
For me, one of the best things about the role is that it's very different day-to-day. So, you know, back in the UK, I'm very much planning the season. I get involved and I have the station budget to work out each year. Then on the ground, I get to support the science, and whether that be in winter or spring with snowmobiles or in summer with the boat. And then alongside all that, there's the political side of things. So I am the UK's representative for NUSMAC, which is the New Ellison Managers Committee. And I sit on that. And it means that there's a sort of a whole host of different angles that the job can take on, which is quite nice. So I absolutely love the changes and the variety.
And Henry, what's it like when you take a minister up to Svalbard? Are they generally quite impressed with the location? Is it quite a lot of responsibility to show them around the village and to prove to them that the science and the funding that you're obtaining for the Arctic is worth it?
Well, we're really lucky because although the station, Harland Coxhusset, is the UK's only permanent Arctic infrastructure, the awareness about it is quite high. And so the excitement and the interest for members of parliament or ministers to visit is really high. But I think they are really impressed when they see it. It's a small facility, our station. We only have 7 bedrooms, but it makes a real impact. Kind of the work that happens there is genuinely really, really good work. And it's feeding into the importance of understanding about the changes in the Arctic. When you think about the Arctic being the region of the world that's warming most quickly, and within the Arctic, Svalbard is the place that's warming most quickly there. And then the west coast of Svalbard, where we have our station, is the bit of Svalbard that's warming the most. It genuinely is kind of the cutting edge of climate change in the world. And so when people come, they can look out of the window, and you can see, if you're there in the winter, that we have open water in the fjord, whereas 10, 15, 20 years ago, this was solid ice all the way across in the winter. And so it's a real easy way to show people about those changes. And then, of course, you can get into the discussion about the new species and the retreating glaciers and everything else. And like anyone, you tell a story, and it's a real story, and members of parliament and ministers can see it, and that makes a real impact on them. And hopefully that makes then an impact down the line when it comes to policy decisions and the real big things that they can influence.
How do you get people onto the station? What are the gateway locations?
You can fly both direct from Oslo and Tromsø, and that takes you into Longyearbyen, which is the capital town of Svalbard, if you like. It's maybe got, I think now, maybe about 2,000, 3,000 people now. It's certainly grown a lot since I first started coming here 10 years ago. It's actually a fairly busy town year-round now, largely due to tourism. So that means that Norwegian Air and Scandinavian Air fly regularly. And in the height of summer, there can be sort of 4 or 5 flights a day from Oslo and Tromsø. From there to New Ellesund, it's just a short hop on a private flight operated by Lufttransport. And that's just a 14-seat aircraft, probably slightly larger than a Bass Twin Otter. And I think my record from leaving my house in Scotland to walking through the door of Harland Coxhusset is 22 hours. We have regular ships that come in. So we have, it's called Norbjørn, which is Northern Bear. And that's the regular cargo ship that comes up from Tromsø to Longyearbyen. And then about once every 4 to 6 weeks, it extends its sail onto New Ellesund. And we get our sort of cargo runs there, but also fruit, veg, and things like that. So again, compared to Rothera, you know, this is year round. We get fruit, veg, and freshies. For those in the know, we get them all year round without any sort of stop in supply. So there's peaks and troughs in the food here, but it's a lot less dependent on sort of tinned or frozen food as it would be in the station south.
Ian, can you describe to us the facilities that you have at New Ellesund to support scientists across, I guess, research topics each year, cover the marine, terrestrial, atmospheric and glacial regions?
We're fairly well set up to support a wide variety of different scientific disciplines. There's generally only one station manager or one operational member of staff on site. So we have, therefore, to limit sort of the number of projects to maybe 3. Just so you can support them safely and effectively. Elsewhere in the station, we have a main lab that people can use and sort of to their own designs, depending on their project. We have fume hoods, laminar flow cabinets you know, ovens, fridges. We have a room with, I think, four microscopes, and then we have water purification in another room. And then we, of course, have the station boat, and we have a full suite of outdoor clothing for available for station users. And then a store that people can, we have a lot of people that come year on year. And so, like, we've got an opportunity for them to store their equipment here. And that sort of saves on a sort of stress and anxiety shipping stuff. But then obviously it reduces the carbon footprint of projects if they don't have to send stuff up. And economically, it's a little bit easier on the pocket. So, and then on the ground, yes, we can, we tend to sort of concentrate primarily on the terrestrial ecology, glacial sort of microbiology, as Henry was talking about, and then the marine science. And we do have some projects that look at atmospheric sort of stuff, and that's primarily recently atmospheric microbes and also atmospheric plastics. But yeah, I'd say our bread and butter is the glaciology, marine and terrestrial ecology projects.
In addition to science roles, Ian, what other roles do you have? I assume you need to have boating officers and field guides in order to transport people to the glaciers and then allow and permit the safe use and work on glacial terrain.
You might assume that. For better or worse, I am the boating manager, the field guide and the station manager. So again, it's you know, personally, that's what makes the role incredible. It's, you know, I get to do everything. Each project goes through an application process. And when I'm looking at planning, I specifically look at what they're planning to do and make sure that I can support it, so I don't get two sort of marine sampling projects in at the same time, both wanting capacity boat use that I can't deliver.
And Henry, you've touched on it, but what is the key focus of Arctic research currently?
So we've had people recently at the station looking at things like plastic pollution on shore and also in the air and on land. All of that is kind of interesting. Part of that is a human story, but it's also, of course, a climate change story because of the way that ocean currents and systems and new fish species are interacting and processing with these elements. We've had people thinking about what the soil will do in the future. So as the soil warms up, what that means for the species that will grow in the region. And increasingly, we're having people look at the glaciers themselves. So people used to think that the glaciers were inert, kind of in the summer and the winter, they would move, but there wasn't much life within them. But increasingly, we're finding that through snow algae and cryoconites and all kinds of other interesting things, there's a real life within the glacier, within the surface of the glacier that's melting in the summer, but down in these sort of these holes, these pits in the surface of the ice as well, and even right down into the melt channels. So there's a whole world that opens up when you begin to look into it. So we don't set the priorities centrally. We let the researchers come up with these ideas. If they're good, they get funded, and then they come to us. And of course, there are ways of coordinating that between the different research stations, so we're not duplicating science. That's important, but we let the researchers themselves come up with these big questions, and if they get funded, then we'll support them if we can. One of the things that we're kind of beginning to kind of think about and make assessments about is, can we improve our models about what will happen in the Arctic? The models give us an ability to predict into the future based on what's happened in the past and what we know now about what, for example, weather or climate or sea ice will be like in the future. And we have fantastic systems, satellite systems, which feed into that. But you do need some validation, some ground truthing of all of those remote sensing systems. And Svalbard is a very good place to begin to do some of that. So I'm hoping that through a wider coordination and a better kind of international partnership system, we can begin to fill some of those gaps in observations and monitoring and understanding so that we can get better at predicting what the future will be like, either through models or through remote sensing.
Roughly each year, how many science projects would you typically support?
So I think in the last couple of years, it's been about 13, 14 projects, but usually some projects come multiple times. So we've been about 16 or 17 sort of individual visits per year, plus, you know, two or three either media or, as Henry was talking about, the sort of MP visits. Or we had our UK ambassador to Norway up last year. So there's the sort of political visits as well. So normally in a year, you'll definitely be just under 20, in a good year, just under 20 sort of individual projects or wanting different either demands on your time or on Cambridge staff time and things like this.
And Henry, do you get to review all of these science projects? Do you have an input in selecting which ones go down and potentially which ones align more closely to NERC's funding?
Yeah, we all work very closely together to make sure that the science we support there is good science, that it's practical, that it's safe, that it meets the objectives. Because it's a brilliant place to do some things, but there are some other things that don't work so well there. So we want to make sure we're aligning the best science to the best location for it to happen.
When you're working with the UK government, how do they respond to securing future money for Arctic research going forwards? You said that they can see the importance of climate change, and do they want to invest in it in the future? Is that a sense of feeling that you're getting?
There's certainly a kind of a keen awareness within government about the importance of research from the Arctic and UK researchers' role in that. All funding decisions from the National Environment Research Council come down from UKRI, and then above them from the department and then into the Treasury. So we don't have any direct relationship or connection to that. But one of the things we want to do is to show MPs, show ministers, show senior people from NERC and UKRI the real value of facilities like the Arctic Station, because it's a straightforward way to get to where you need to do your research. You can do it very efficiently and effectively, get out, publish, make your data available. And I think there's an increasing focus within government and within the research councils on making that connection between the work that we do, the research that we know, and people's daily lives and their futures, making sure that kind of there's a practical application to as much as possible. And I know that everything that we do out of the Arctic Station has some kind of practical connection, whether it's to climate targets or whether it's to kind of pollution knowledge or knowledge about changing ecosystems and what that's doing to fish and fish stocks in the future. All of that has a practical application, and increasingly that's where government is looking. And I think we're in a good place to meet that challenge.
Well, it's great to hear that they understand the societal benefit. That's really positive, and I really hope there is future funding. Talking about the future, Ian, how do you feel about the future of the Arctic and Arctic research and New Alesund as a station?
In terms of the future of the Arctic, I think it's hard not to sound negative, I suppose, here. It's just, but I've been coming to the polar regions for sort of 16, 17 years, and the Arctic for 10 years. And even in such a short space of time, you know, the changes are visible. The changes are sort of, you think of these things as taking place over, say, a lifetime, but actually it's far, far quicker than that. And things are really accelerating. So, you know, in our fjord and in the peninsula that New Alesund is on, the glaciers maybe start at 600-700 meters altitude, and they no longer accumulate. So they're not dying, they're dead, you know. So it's the reality is that in the summer months, the glaciers are black and gray. All that winter snow that covers them has melted away. The surface therefore, absorbs more radiation, and the process accelerates even more. I think one of the local glaciers, over its entire surface area, it melted by 5 centimeters in depth in a 24-hour period last summer. So, you know, this isn't, you know, we're talking like they melt over a couple of meters each year, but in one sort of 24-hour period, it melted 5 centimeters. It's just an incredible amount of ice being lost. And because it's no longer accumulating, it's a real sort of sad, you know, to see one way track. And we have, you know, we go up year on year to the same glaciers, and they'll be retreating 10, 20 meters year on year. But on a lighter note, I hope to be in this position for many years, because I think, you know, the fact that things are changing and changing in that way, I think is very important, because this is an opportunity for us to see and study firsthand what effects are, you know, happening because of climate change, and maybe learning a little bit from the sort of the active part of the warming planet to sort of learn more about what we can do and how we can maybe help the parts that are warming less quickly.
And Henry, in terms of policy is really driving everything. It's one thing having good science and understanding the mechanisms of change, but really we need political change in order to reverse this priming of carbon into the atmosphere. Are you hopeful that that can happen?
Yeah, I think you have to be cautiously optimistic. Svalbard's future in the future, it will look much more like Scotland than it looks like now. Essentially, it's a similar size. Of course, it's further north, but everyone is suggesting that by 2040, there will be very little summer sea ice in the Arctic. That change is sadly locked in. So on the one hand, you have to realize the change that's locked in, but there are other changes which are not yet locked in. And those are the ones where we need to take brave decisions now on the international scale, at COP, at the IPCC, about carbon, greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, because it is those processes that are driving change in the Arctic. And one of the things that makes the Arctic kind of special, of course, is that people live in the Arctic. Although there is no permanent indigenous population in Svalbard, there are 4 million people that live above the Arctic Circle, and 1 in 10, 400 of thousands of those, have an indigenous heritage. And so when we talk about the Arctic and we talk about the future of the Arctic, we're talking not just about the environment and the charismatic megafauna that are there and the whole ecosystem. We're talking about millions and millions of people. And they, above anyone else, have an investment in the future of the Arctic. They have a right to development and sustainable development, and they will take choices about what happens in their countries. That's different to what it feels like in the Central Arctic Ocean. But if you're in northern Canada or northern Norway or northern Russia, you are as much in the Arctic as you are in Longyearbyen or at our station in New Orleans.
Yeah, a really societal important aspect, which I think is becoming recognised more and more. So to conclude, finally, I'd like to know what it's like to see a polar bear.
I remember seeing my first one. I was actually in the Arctic Ocean at the edge of the pack ice somewhere between Greenland and Svalbard on a tourist ship, and having to pretend to the other tourists that I'd seen them many times and I wasn't excited, and oh, it's just a polar bear. But inside I was extremely excited. It's an incredible animal to see, and to see it sort of not necessarily up close but in its natural domain. It's a powerful symbol of the Arctic, I think. But I think it's definitely also worthy to note the other wildlife that's up here. It's definitely, the polar bear is obviously iconic, but there is, as Henry talked about whales earlier, we saw beluga the other day from the boat. We have the puffins, which are beautiful to see. There's numerous seals and walrus, and we have the polar fox, which is a beautiful white. We call it the budget bear, but it's a beautiful white in winter. As now it's sort of more mottled sage and reindeer wandering around the town and things. So there's a lot of life in the Arctic, and it's incredible to see all of it.
Yeah, the first one I saw was from a boat in the fjord in Kongsfjord. And that was wonderful because we were seeing a bear and a cub up on a bird cliff, and they were scavenging for dead chicks or eggs or kind of whatever they could find up on the cliff. And that was brilliant because we were so far out that we weren't bothering them. They weren't going to bother us because we were in a boat. And so that was a perfect place to see them. Bears are amazing to see, but you ideally want to see them kind of some distance away. The best animal I've ever seen in Svalbard is a walrus. We saw a walrus haul out 3-4 years ago, and that was spectacular. The smell as they're wallowing around in the shallows, and the noise and the sound and the sheer scale of the animals, because you could get not super close, but a bit closer than you would with a bear. And they were really, really impressive. I was very, very impressed with the walruses. That whole surround sound visceral experience was really special. And that's not what you want to have with a bear. But the walrus, that was cool.
And on a personal level, as the head of the NERC Arctic Office, what do you hope to achieve in the next future years in your post?
Well, I'm hoping I can play a role in making the International Polar Year something that's really, really special and unique. The previous ones have delivered incredible results for science, huge advances in the polar regions. So it'd be nice to make some kind of even small contribution at a personal level, and also to find a role for the Arctic Station in Svalbard within the Polar Year. That would be fantastic.
Such a positive note to end on. Thank you to both Ian and Henry for taking the time to talk about their Arctic roles and their optimism for all the upcoming developments that will see the New Orleans base kept busy for many years to come. To find out more about NERC and how to submit scientific research projects for use of the NERC Arctic Research Station, visit arctic.ac.uk. You can also sign up to the UK NERC Arctic Office mailing list for more updates, and do have a look at the links in the episode notes if you would like to go on a virtual tour of New Orleans Research Station from your home. Next time, we'll be speaking to the Bass Polar Deployment Support Manager, Michaela Boke, about how to prepare people for the polar regions each year. And if you learned something new when listening today, tell us. Make sure you leave a review on the Ice World page or wherever you get your podcasts. 5 stars, please. I'm Nadia Frontier, and thank you for listening.